An African education. My own real education began in Africa. Some dozen or so years before the applesauce mix incident, I was flying over the Sahara Desert on my way to Freetown, Sierra Leone. It was 1963 and I was all of 21. The tragic events of the Civil War during the 1990s were as yet a long way off into the future. Sierra Leone was a British colony in tropical West Africa. It became an independent country in 1961. During the height of the slave trade, slaves were taken from these lands. Later, when the trade ended, Freetown was founded as a colony for freed slaves. The country had at least a dozen tribal languages, English and Creole being spoken almost everywhere. As I arrived, the place was full of optimism. The best of the West and the best of Africa could be found in happy combination. A childhood dream of coming to Africa was fulfilled. This was to be my home for a year. I was part of a merry band of volunteers, VSOs, youngsters, volunteering for overseas service, setting out to explore the world. Years later, I realised that we were also part of an army of Westerners, bringing transnational corporate culture, power, corruption, war, the IMF and the world economy to Africa. As young people, we learned so much of lasting value from the many local peoples amongst whom we lived and worked. Bow School was situated in Bow, 136 miles up country from the cooler air of Freetown. The school was founded to educate the sons of chiefs in the ways of British administration. I taught history of the colonial era, also some English, and I taught A-level economics. Lessons lasted as long as the school bell thought fit. I laid aside my watch for a year. An invitation to dine with the local village chief was a bit of a puzzle. This happened soon after we arrived. We, my colleague Roz and I, were served by the chief's three wives. Conversation lacked sparkle, causing us to wonder why had he bothered to invite us. The mystery was solved a few days later. The three wives of the Mendi village chief summoned me into their presence at the Cheshire home where I was helping with children with disability. What did he talk about? Nothing in particular. Well, of course, he knows nothing. And so began the start of my real education. The women later introduced me to traditional skills of cooking, weaving, fishing, sewing, dyeing cloth, music, dance and so on. You poor white things, they would say, you don't know how to enjoy yourselves. Why have you white women let your men get out of hand? Was the question which rather threw me on that first day. You can let men talk, but you do not give them power. That didn't fit at all with what I had been taught about the position of women in indigenous pre-industrial societies. These women were farmers, market traders, wheelers and dealers in the local economy. In addition, they brought up the next generation. Through daily cooperation, and in sickness and in health, they organised the real resources of the village. The chief, and the men generally, had the titles, ornaments and trappings of prestige. They could talk, but they had no real power. United, these women could use the best of Western technology and culture, adapting it to their own ends. They valued their sewing machines, fine machine textiles, and certain medicines. But these were adapted to suit their chosen way of life. These Mendi women knew that already their chiefs and politicians were being bribed with big money to sell whole districts for development by corporate world powers. Subsequent history confirmed their worst fears.